This conversation was recorded on February 18th, 2008, in the home of Mike Abrams at Kendall at Ithaca. Those present were Jonathan Culler, Neil Hertz, Mike Abrams, and Corey Earle.
We might as well introduce ourselves. I'm Jonathan Culler, class of 1916, professor of English and comparative literature at Cornell. I'm here with M.H. Abrams, former class of 1916 professor of English.
Harold Bloom calls a precursor.
Precursor. And Neil Hertz, who's a professor of English at Johns Hopkins, who spent many years at Cornell as Mike's colleague. And you're here to talk about the Cornell history of the Cornell English Department, English studies, the Norton Anthology, and such topics of that sort. So maybe, Mike, we should just start by, if you could tell us something about what brought you to Cornell, how you ended up here in the English department.
Yeah, it was, I was an instructor at Harvard at the time, and there was a suspension of all that during the Second World War, when I was invited, to my surprise, by the scientists who were running what was called the Psychoacoustic Laboratory at Harvard, which, in service of the military, all the military divisions, dealing with all the aspects of communications, oral communications in noisy environments. But when the war ended, I was invited to visit Cornell and a couple of other places. I think one was Minnesota. I did go out there. And the other was Berkeley. And I really had no intention of leaving Harvard. There's no point in doing it. I could have stayed on a bit anyway. But I was so enchanted by the lake, the landscape, and the general air of reality at Cornell's compared to Harvard.
Reality.
That I decided right then and there, I thought it'd be interesting to see the place, and I decided right then and there, to my own surprise, that this was a place to go. So I called up my wife, and I said, "Ruthie, have you heard this story?"
Yeah,
I called up Ruthie and I said to her, "Ruthie, we're moving to Ithaca." And she said, "Where's that?" But she arrived with a 6-month-old baby, our older daughter, and soon struck roots.
Mm-hmm. So that was 1946?
45. The agreement, one of the reasons I really wasn't interested in going anywhere for a while, at any rate, was I'd been granted what was called a Rockefeller post-war fellowship to get you established after the war. But Cornell agreed to let me postpone that for a year and take it the year afterward. So I went off in 46 then to Cambridge and worked on what became the Mirror and the Lamb, or what was already named that. Then I came back after that.
So it was not the English department itself that attracted you, but the landscape.
The English department was in the
same. You want to tell us something about the English department you discovered? Was this reality when you got here?
Well, I didn't know much about this when I visited. Yes. Or I might have been a little less eager to. But what was left of the English department after the losses of personnel through retirement and war and so on, before 1945, saw its points. And the three most prominent people in the department, I remember, were Cecil Bald, who was an Australian, who finally went off to the University of Chicago, and Bill Sale, a powerful figure, especially interested in novels. And Harold Thompson, who was a pioneer in taking seriously folklore and folk songs. And they didn't get along at all. Each scorned the other, and Bill Sale had nothing but contempt. The class had kind of a puritanical sense of what belongs in serious literary study. Harold was just ahead of his time. But I never visited his course, but Harold Thompson taught a course where, in the folk song, where he had all the great folk singers come and Really? They were delighted to be invited. It was so rare. But
he got Leadbelly to come here, I think.
Yeah, and Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger. They were all here. Wow. Wow. And then the students would sing. Mm-hmm. So the students named his course Rump and Stomp. That was one of the things that irritated us. But I remember it was a famous course. I remember one time I was walking over Tripphammer Bridge and the car drove up and this student leaned out and said, "Sir, can you tell me where Romp and Stomp meets?" And I discovered he was a student at University of Syracuse, and he'd heard about the course way over there as Romp and Stomp. That was it. So I told him, yes, I knew where it meant.
That's
But at any rate, it was in a state of dishevelment when I arrived. And I discovered, in fact, I should have been suspicious because the person who offered me the job on my visit here was not anybody in English. It was a man called Sabine, S-A-B-I-N-E, a very distinguished political scientist. And I thought, well, maybe he was a provost or something. It wasn't that at all. He'd been put in charge of the English department, which couldn't govern itself. So they needed an outside autocrat to govern it.
And was Lane Cooper still around?
Lane Cooper was still around. He was around for years afterward. He'd retired from teaching, but he used to go to the early Rotskeller, the original Statler. The old faculty club, which is a charming little place, really, in the basement.
I remember the Rats Garden, yes. Yeah,
families used to go there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I remember Harry Levin came for a visit from Harvard. He was an old friend of mine, and it was his first visit to Cornell. And we were standing in line for lunch at Statler, and I said to Harry, have you met Lane Cooper? He was in the line in front of us. Harry turned pale as a ghost. He told me after, I thought he'd been dead for 20 years. Uh-huh.
So you came to a department that in disarray. How did that story work out eventually? Presumably eventually they came out of receivership. Did you have a hand in this?
We hired like crazy after the war. And all sorts of people who wouldn't have been considered for jobs before came here, and they're all interesting people with few exceptions, and the old-timers who couldn't get along were just simply outvoted in no time. I think within 2 or 3 years we doubled or more the size of the department, all with younger people. I remember Francis Meineke, the Victorian scholar, was brought here from Texas and soon was appointed chairman. He was an enormous peacemaker because his technique, I discovered, was when a contentious issue turned up, which he knew in advance would be contentious, he'd patiently go from office to office, talk to each voter, each teacher, independently, and get the thing worked out so that when we finally met, it was all harmony. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing thing. Of course, he was infinitely patient. He was supposed to spend infinite amount of time doing it. But after that, it became probably the most peaceful department of its size in the country, possibly through the dire war that happened before.
When did Baxter Hathaway arrive?
In 1946. I think he was hired while I was on leave. And I think Jim McConkie about the same time. And so the writing department got a big boost, and Hathaway, in his odd, long, quiet, understated way, almost incoherent way when he talked, really developed a powerhouse department. Not to everybody's delight. I remember Arthur Meisner was one of the people brought in here. Arthur had been at Wells College and had wanted to come to Cornell for years. There's been some dissension about him. And then done that important book he did on Scott Fitzgerald. So he was brought here from Carleton, where he'd gone. And he never thought that writing belonged in the English department, but was not militant about it, so it was all right.
So the writing program developed really as an independent program, or did those people teach literature courses too?
I think flexibly they could move in and out of teaching all sorts of courses. And it's pretty much the way it still is, I think.
So the main change shortly after you came was simply an increase in size and therefore sort of overcoming the difficult. The previous quarrels, except for the issue of folklore, did not have to do with theoretical positions. It was really just that they didn't get along with each other?
Or? I think it was more the latter than the former, but there was, both Bill Sale and Cecil Ball agreed in one thing, and that is disapproving of Harold Thompson, regardless of what he taught.
Yes, I see.
Even though Harold Thompson had published a very distinguished, very scholarly book on the sensibility novelist, the Scottish man of feeling. You know,
Mackenzie.
And it's a very good book. And it was really about the Scottish Enlightenment, of which Mackenzie was a part. But then he moved into folk stuff. We developed a very diverse department in astonishingly short time. We had what must have been one of the most interesting departments in the country, maybe the most. I've told this story before, and you may have heard it, Jonathan. Looking back, at the time I didn't think anything of it, but looking back, this was the situation in the early 1950s. I had an office in Goldsmith on the main floor, near the one where I've been until recently. And right around the corner was Morris Bishop, a man of very great distinction and a wonderful raconteur and after-dinner speaker and man of the world, cosmopolitan. And a great humorist, of course. Next to him was Vladimir Nabokov, who had come here. Morris brought him here. And next to him was David Dacius, who was hired right after the war, 1946. Through Cecil Ball, who somehow got to know about him. David had been in the British Embassy during the war in Washington, and I think Ball had read some of his publications and wrote to him and found he was available, and he was hired here. We hired Bandley in those days. And down the hall was Robert Martin Adams, also a very distinguished man of letters, as it turned out. And there we all were together, and with Dacius typing mentally at one end of the hall and Adams typing mentally at the other end of the hall, that clatter, clatter going in a kind of co-responsive way, driving us all crazy. Because we sat idly while they were busy churning out material. But no, that was an extraordinary group, both not only in its quality, but its diversity. And that, the department, of course they weren't all in the same department, but they're all literary people.
Yes.
And right next to each other in that wonderful building, Goldsmith, philosophy in the same building, and all the other literature in the same building. That's a very important thing. It was for me very important to have people who worked in areas that I myself spread out into, which was very important for the work I was doing, all in the same building.
Had Max Black arrived?
Oh yes, he came in 46, 40. I mean, the kind of hiring that, and the quality of the people that were hired, it can't have been totally luck that we got such first-rate people. We got not only Max Black in philosophy, but Norman Malcolm, the great Wittgensteinian, with whom Wittgenstein came to stay for a number of months while he was dying. He kept it quiet. Richard Robinson in philosophy, who went off to Oxford afterward, an Englishman. And various other very distinguished philosophers all came here at once. The man who wrote the book on justice, Rawls, was at Cornell.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was here. And another man who went to Dartmouth from here, a good friend of Rawls. I can't think of his name. No, it was a remarkable department. Remarkable. I think the most distinguished the country at the time.
Did Nabokov have much relation with the English department or people in the English department? Or did he? Because he was, of course, giving these famous, now famous lectures on literature.
Yeah,
did
they people were famous people, among the students at the time.
But faculty didn't go to, I guess he wasn't
well,
yet famous as a novelist.
Steve Parrish says he heard most of the lectures because he had an office next to what was then Goldsmith A, where he gave those lectures. He said he could hear them through through the wall. But the students caught on to it very quickly as oddball, but terribly interesting. Nabokov had no close friends. Even Morris Bishop, who brought him here, probably is his nearest thing to a close friend. I probably knew him, next to Morris, I probably knew him as well as anybody, which was on the level of friendly acquaintance. He developed no intimacies at all. He and his wife were the intimates, and his son when he was around. And of course he was difficult because you didn't know which were the buttons you mustn't touch, which made him very angry.
And there were a lot of them.
There were a lot of them, but most of them had to do with Soviet Russia. He would hear no good about Soviet Russia. You would hear no neutral things about Soviet Russia. Anti-Semitism was another one of these. Because his wife was Jewish. His father had been a great Russian liberal. Had been assassinated, of course. And there were things... You mustn't like certain novelists. I kept forgetting which were which. I couldn't figure out exactly why. Dostoevsky, you must say nothing good about.
He didn't like Balzac, either.
I've forgotten. Was Balzac one of the negatives? Probably. Yeah. Jane Austen, I think, was a little neutral about perhaps not Jane Austen. But I in those days, I used to memorize it. But he was an extraordinary guy.
Did you recognize Cornell characters in his novels? Were the novels that he wrote?
Well, the one everybody thought they knew was Pnin, mm-hmm. who was a historian, a Polish historian named Szeftel, Jewish Polish, and who was a little like Pnin. I mean, he never quite. Got it. He was very good humored about it and liked America and all that, but he never got with it. He didn't quite fit. But I think what Nabokov said was probably 3/5 true. That Pnin is me. I mean, it's on it. It's himself. His own bewilderments. And I think a very good book, one of the great comic novels in America, I think. Do people still read it?
I think, oh yes. Yeah. But you don't recognize in the other professorial characters as Cornellians of the day.
I never did. And I never heard anybody claim they did.
Just curious.
I still remember, I read it only once when it first came out, but the wonderful time he was being visited by his very American nephew. Discovered his nephew was interested in football, so he read up about football in the encyclopedia to conduct conversations with his nephew, which he did, but it turned out to be soccer. Well, so if Pnin was Nabokov, he had this totally double vision of himself.
Well, let's see. So we have this incredibly distinguished group of people in Goldensmith. I guess we have to hear about how it all went downhill. One corner of Goldensmith. So at that point, there still were no women in the department. Were they? Or when did women start being hired or brought in? Or mostly they were lecturers
I'm
first?
I'm not sure whether the first one was Jean Blackwell, or she became Jean France when she came here. She may have been the first, but she was followed soon by others. Once women joined the department, they were hired in substantial numbers.
Was there a big argument about that, about whether women should be hired, or when it began?
I don't remember any heated arguments. Certainly, probably demurrals, mutterings, but I don't remember there's any quarrel about it. It just seemed a natural thing to do. Everything had been so changed by that Second World War that all sorts of earlier prejudices against Jews, for example, as well as women. There are many Jewish members of who were hired, not only in English, but all the other departments. When I first came to Cornell, I think there were two non-Jews in the whole of the Cornell faculty, and maybe a third or fourth who were converts, or families earlier converted. And within a few years, I imagine the English department, at a sheer guess, became one-third Jewish before the 40s, 1940s were out.
Harry Kaplan had been in classics for a while.
He was one of the two. Harry Kaplan, remarkably in classics, of course, of all departments. And the other one was Wally Horowitz, who was a mathematician, loved to play the stock market. He used to go down to bars, stock brokers in town, and play the stock market with some kind of mathematical formula. I'm sure he seemed to do all right. But he was a very nice man. Of course, Harry Kaplan's one of the great campus characters. Students used to line up at class reunions waiting to go in and say hello to Harry.
So in your early years here, did you teach primarily courses on Romanticism mostly? Did you start teaching the survey course?
Started in the 18th century.
18th century.
The first courses I taught here, freshman composition, 18th century, and a graduate course in 18th century. And I kept that up for some time before I moved past the period divide into Romantic period. Yeah, when Tom Pynchon took the course, for example, he was in the course in the 18th century. And as I remember, because in mind, which birthday was it? 95th, yes. So 95th. Tom Pynchon actually sent me two of his books, in which he referred to my 18th century course. And I remember now he wrote a term paper on Johnson's Rasselas and Voltaire's Candide. It was a brilliant paper. I didn't know who he was at the time. He was publishing chunks of what became the novel V in the Trojan Horse, or whatever the student organ was called at the time. And those were remarkable. I mean, patently remarkable. But I did notice his name. When he turned up on the course roster, I didn't recognize his name. And he wrote a brilliant paper, I wish I'd kept it, on Voltaire, on Candide and Rasselas. And I did what people do. I knew it was cribbed. But I couldn't charge him with it because I couldn't prove it. So I wrote on the cover, "This is the most interesting paper. I hope you'll come to see me about it at your early convenience." And this slender young man with a little pencil mustache appeared. It soon became apparent that this was the guy who'd written those things, so I knew that it was his essay. And I remember saying to him, "What honor seminar are you in?" We had the seminar system for honor students, special seminars just for them. And he said, "Oh, I'm not in any of them." I said, "Why not?" He said, "I'm not good enough." "Really? You're serious?" I said, "What makes you think so?" So I know some of my friends are in it, they're much better than I am. I thought he was pulling my leg, you know, but later that was part of his oddity, his tremendous self-appreciation. The one person he knew best, Tom Pynchon, at Cornell, was Baxter Hathaway, for whom he had great respect as his mentor in writing. Baxter, when he spoke, there'd be 10 seconds between some of his words.
Yes.
You remember Baxter. But he was very impressive with good students in writing. And I think he corresponded with, alone of all the people, Possibly Jim McConkie also has letters from him. Otherwise, of course, he just hid away. He's mm-hmm. still hiding away. Yes. Strange man.
So when did you start teaching Romanticism? This was all while you were working on the mirror and the lamp, but you still weren't teaching the Romantics at all?
I don't remember the year I moved up. It was probably
in
the early 50s. Yeah, we'd have to look at the records. And I never went back to the 18th century, but I never lost my affection for it. I really like the Enlightenment. I mean, hard things are being said about it these days. I think, well, it was made America, of course. I was never a derogator of Dryden, Pope, and the rest of Johnson, one of my heroes. Glad to say he's also Harold Bloom's hero. Harold and I share a great admiration for Johnson.
And did you teach survey? Did you teach the kind of course that then became the Norton Anthology, or was that? Is there an English tab?
I had taken what was then called a survey course, maybe still is, and at Harvard, and it was taught by some good people and some people not so good. I won't name names, but there was one teacher who was in charge of it. I was an assistant in that course over a process of years, and I think three different people taught it. And one of them, his way of teaching the course was to put on his glasses and read a poem. Today, gentlemen in those days, gentlemen, we deal with Robert Browning, one of the great, great English poets. I will now read My Last Duchess, one of the great, great English poems. Then he would read it, and he would take off his glasses and says, gentlemen, that is poetry. But then it was taught by other people who were much better. But the old survey course, a little of this and a little of that, and the anthologies were usually more snippety than not. And when I came here, David Deitchis and I decided we'd inaugurate a very serious survey course. He took the first half and I took the second. And we developed a reading list and so on. That was the basis of the Norton Anthology, because David and I were both editors of that. I got David on the staff, about which is a funny story. You want to hear it?
Yes.
I was sitting in my office, I think it was 169 in those days in Goldman Smith, and there was a knock on the door, and a very nice-looking man appeared, and he described himself as the president, George Brockway, the president of W.W. Norton and Company, and he had just been visiting with his classmate at Williams College. What's his name? Robert, the Americanist who moved to Martha's Vineyard.
Bob Elias.
Bob Elias, right. Yes. And my classmate, Bob Elias. And we're interested in doing an anthology of English literature. And Robert said, you taught that sort of a course. We'd like to talk to you about it. That was how we got to doing it. And when I agreed to do it, I thought it would take maybe a year of my time. It took four full-time years. But he said, there's just one thing. He had this new format, you see, which was important. Bible paper, and you could get a lot, and single columns, and the things we still do. And he said, just one thing. We started this anthology some years ago under the leadership of a scholar at Michigan. The thing fell through. And so we dissolved the earlier group, and you're at liberty to appoint any people you like, as many as you like, to work with you. That's your choice, with one exception, and that is a man whom we still have, we carried over from the old anthology. I said, why is that? He said, because he's the only one bright enough to have asked for an advance. Norton's was not in great shape in those days, you see. And I said, what's his name? He said, David Teach. I said, my friend, we teach the course together. So we developed the course and then worked out the anthology.
Uh-huh. That's good. So at that stage, in the first Norton anthology, probably was a very canonical collection. I haven't gone back to look at the earliest. Probably not many women writers yet. What?
Not until the 19th century, when you came to the women novelists and so on. And 20th century, of course, there were women, but nothing. I mean, more than one person has come to me with a project saying, would we give him permission to write the history of Norton anthology as a kind of key to academic taste and or academic judgment about canonical authors and all the rest, which I thought was not a bad idea, but I've not heard from. After they seem to start doing research, but I don't know if they're still going on with it or not. But anyway, one of the big things is the constant increment in women authors. Mm-hmm. Not from the second edition, but the third, fourth, somewhere then. And now, of course, a very great number of women.
So is that driven by the responses you get from users, or is that driven by your own re-estimation of reading and re-estimation of the
authors? Well, it's partly the latter, but even more importantly, the former. The Norton people, the editors in-house, right from the second edition, and there have been new editions every 6 or 7 years, got the notion of sending out questionnaires to a very large selection of adopters, asking them to give their judgment on the content and what should be added, what might be omitted. Well, most people didn't want to omit very much, but they all wanted to add a lot, so the things kept growing in size. But that questionnaire got more and more detailed until very soon it consisted of a printed out table of contents of the last edition in which you actually checked the items you taught, and then there was another column for checking the items, which even if you didn't teach them, you thought they belonged in. And there's another item, dispensable, another column. So we got and then we asked them to comment on all these things. And some people were extremely conscientious. We used to get responses from about 150 users. I mean, an enormous sample of we sent requests even more, but we used to get very serious responses in detail, and people said, "Oh, we don't believe you that we paid great," but of course that was an incalculably useful mine of information as to which way the wind was blowing. And we paid great heed to that.
Did the editors? Did you all meet together to work out what to do, or did you just?
Never met together.
I'd
still attribute some of our success in getting along with each other because we had some some rather maverick editors like Bob Adams himself. Yes. But we never met together. The only time we met, and then never as a group as I recall, was those of us who went to the MLA used to see each other at a little gathering for the Norton people at MLA. So we never had the chance to quarrel personally.
So you would hash out the decisions with the individual section editors of the individual sections each chapter.
And the other editors would ask for their advice consequential decision. Not a petty matter, but a consequential. Yeah. So it was really a joint product in its contents and everything else.
So has the evolution slowed down at this point? Or have we discovered all the writers who might be included?
Now the addition of women has slowed down because we run out of women.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
Women are coming in about the same rate as men now after outnumbering them as additions for a long time. But the big new additions now are Anglophone writers, because that's the way that teachers are moving now. They want to teach those people, and so there are more and more of them in the recent editions.
Well, coming back to Cornell for a moment then, were there were there debates and arguments within the department about the expansion of the canon, expansion of the purview of an English department, which occurred through the years?
No, because we didn't have a comprehensive examination for students, either students or anybody else, and that would have been the focal point of such quarrels. But, you know, the old Cornell system was everybody teaches his own course, and the hell with you. I never knew anybody who made inquiries, negative inquiries about the contents of anybody else's course. So people taught what they thought they ought to teach in whatever area they taught their courses.
Well, I'll tell you one funny story about Bill Sale.
Okay.
The second year I was here, they asked me to do the honors freshman English introduction to poetry. And Bill Sale was doing the introduction to fiction, and Tony Caputi was doing the introduction to drama. So, to get started, I typed out a sheet and brought it to the secretaries for the first day's reading. I thought, freshmen are often scared of poetry, so I'm going to give them a passage of prose and a poem, and reassure them the same kinds of questions that you ask about prose, which they should feel okay with, you can ask about poetry. So I typed out a paragraph from a Saul Bellow story, Seize the Day, and a short poem of Robert Frost, and I submitted it to the department secretaries. Next day I got a call from Bill Sale.
I'll be darned.
He said, I see you've got a piece of prose on this sheet you're using. I said, yeah, and I explained why I was doing that. He said, you're poetry, boy. I'm prose.
That's his laconic.
That's his style.
Exactly. Right. That was that, eh?
That was that. Uh-huh. I passed it out anyway.
Oh, Bill Sale, he was a martinet, and many students some students couldn't stand him, and others just adored him.
Yep.
And very good students. One or two went on to the New Yorker staff and so on, and they came back to see Bill Sale all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, he's a witty man.
He was, yeah, in his somewhat assiduous way.
Yep.
But he was chair at some point. Mm-hmm.
He was chair when
I came. If you had a martinet as a chair, that would create some divisions within the department and arguments.
He was not nominal chair when I came because the thing was really being run by Sabin. But he was, Sabin conferred with Bill. Bill was really the power in the department at that time, despite the fact that the two of the other leading figures couldn't get along with him. And then he became nominal chair. For a while, we had the department was run when Sabin got tired of doing it or got busy doing something else. The thing was turned over to Tom Bergen, who was an Italianist, went on to Yale, and he ran the English department. You can see what a sad state we must have been in those days. But we seem to learn from that. I think we probably owe to the era of the nadir of the English department, mutual compatibility with people later on, because enough of us remember that awful time, so we do what we had to avoid.
So once you got back to your self-governance, where did you have the people, did you have a succession of chairs who served for short terms, or did you have any of these long-term, in some departments at Cornell, there were people who would be chair for 10 years?
No, we always had a terminal appointment. I think it was 5 years.
5 years.
Still 5 years.
Well, now most people don't want to do it for more than three, so
yeah,
it's hard to get.
I think it was five.
I was hired by Bill Keech.
Bill Keech, yes.
And then
Rekeast,
and then he stopped, and Sale became chairman again for a few years. And then Epp, I guess, after that, Epp Fogel.
Epp Fogel was chairman for a while.
Were you ever chair?
Oh, no.
You were very clever about that.
I was very agile. I never wanted to be chair, and I always admired people who did. Some faculty people are, as anybody's been chair, present company not accepted, would know, some people are automatically against authority. whether you're a chairperson or a dean or a president of the university, there again you're. And I, on the other hand, I've always been so extremely grateful for anybody who's willing to do that, that job, that I've always been pro-authority. I've always been pro-chair, pro-dean, pro-president.
Excellent. So you didn't have jobs like director of graduate studies, or you managed to avoid
those
jobs? Of course, running the Norton. When did you?
I feel guilty about having evaded them, having other people.
Administering the Norton was a big administrative job, pulling all those things together. When did the Norton start? I've forgotten.
It took us 4 years to finish it, and then another year probably before it appeared in print. And it appeared in print first in 1957. It's half a century old. More. So going back 5 years, 52
You were always occupied with some kind of administrative activities.
True. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. There was always, my hands were always full.
A good excuse.
Then the glossary literary terms.
That
was another thing that kept your nose to the grindstone, in addition to teaching and writing and so on. Because that kept coming out new editions every 6 or 7 years, pari passu, with the Norton Anthology. And that took a lot of. But all I had to do was administer myself then. I didn't have 7 colleagues.
Yes.
But it was still time-consuming.
And you're doing another edition of the glossary now?
I'm doing the index right now. One of the 3 indices, indexes right now on the 9th edition.
Are there many new terms that have come in since the 8th edition that you had neglected before?
Well, there are a lot of little new terms, but there are big new essays on fine arts, which I've always been interested in, the concept of fine arts, when it developed, how it developed. So this, I think, a very interesting little essay on that. And there's one on what is a new area of publication, communication at the MLA and so on, called book history studies. Do you want to think about book history studies? If you don't, you can read the new edition. And then, in order to back up or put underpinning under that one, I decided to do a new essay on book, the history of the book, which is a wonderful history, of course, when they use scrolls and so on, and the codices coming in, and then printing press and all the differences that made. So there's a new essay on that. So they're very substantial new essays.
I see. So how do you have some system for working out what needs to be taken account of in the glossary? Do you go through MLA programs to something like to see, or just occurred to you that there was this new area of history of the book?
Questionnaires.
They do questionnaires too.
On a much smaller scale than the big anthology. Yes, and book history studies, I'd never heard of it until somebody said you ought to do an essay on book history studies, and I'll do it for you on request. Often that is the way suggestions. And I said, thank you. And so I looked it up and decided, yes, I'm going to go in because it's a flourishing study. Fine arts was my addition.
That makes sense given the connection between literary studies and visual studies these days.
Well, some interesting things going on in the field called book history studies. And that includes the impact made by print, when print culture, so-called, began to displace the manuscript culture. It is an important field of work.
Well, let's see.
We ought to puck this man.
Yes.
How did you have to come to Cornell, Neil?
Helen Vendler was here.
That's right.
And
we had some wonderful people here.
And Paul DeMann was here.
Yeah, another wonderful person.
I had known Paul because we were in the same close reading course. Each of us had a section of Reuben Brower's course at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And we had team taught a thing, and I'd heard some lectures of his. So I knew I wanted to hear more from him. And then when Helen Vendler called up late, like in February, and said, Cornell needs another person, and I suggested your name.
She was only an instructor here.
She was only an instructor. I guess Keast had asked her. And she
obviously
said,
was terribly bright. I mean,
she said she knew somebody of her cohort at graduate school that was on the market. So this was all done by telephone. Keast called me up and offered me a job, and I thought about it for a day.
Just like that.
And took it. And then the following thing happened. We came up in June to buy a house, or look for a house. And Helen gave a party for us, where she was living on Du Bois Road.
Way the deuce out in the wilderness, yeah. I remember, yeah.
And the whole department was there, and met all sorts of people. And I'd been told at that point that I was going to be teaching three sections of freshman composition and one section of the Great Books course, from Homer to whatever.
Three compositions?
Maybe two. No, I think it was four and four.
Yeah, I think it was first year. Was that a teacher?
Yeah.
Four?
Yeah. And I'd been trained by Brower to believe that you had to know the language you were reading the book in if you're going to do a real close reading. So I didn't like the idea of a Great Books course. And when I was introduced to Keast out at Helen Vendler's party, I said, look, I would really prefer if I could do a section of the Norton Anthology course instead of the Great Books course. Keast said, fine. And I went home and told Louise, it's incredible. You meet the chair of the department, you ask for something, he gives it to you. What a place. Then we went back to Cambridge. We moved up in late August. I went into the department office and discovered I was still in the Great Books course.
That was Keast's work. He meant well, but he forgot to
mention. So I was furious. I was furious. I was reading Homer like mad in the early days of September. But it worked out.
Did you change to the other course after that?
Eventually,
he simply slipped his mind, I'm sure.
Eventually, a year or so later, I was assisting in your course. I can remember, because I remember when Wayne Booth came to visit. He just published the book on irony, and you were lecturing on irony. We were both sitting in the back of the room listening to that.
So was David Deitch still here then? Or
no, I didn't meet. I never met Deitch. He must have left before 1961.
Yeah, he must have left in 59 or 60, somewhere in there. Yeah.
And Nabokov had left by that time.
Yeah.
But Adams was still around. I had
a lot
of talk with Robert Adams. We taught a course together, Senior Honors.
Did you? Yeah. I just remembered when Bob Adams, I gave a little talk at you were there, weren't you, at the recent funeral of Tony Capote,
yes.
Blessed Memory.
Yes.
And what I didn't remember at that time, I remember now, is you'll recall this because you were here at the time, I'm sure, Neil. When Bob Adams taught a course in Metamorphoses, you remember that? You know, that indicates the freedom given to the faculty. He decided to teach a course in Metamorphoses. And it started with Ovid and went on. And at the end of the course, he's giving his terminal lecture. A great black coat, hooded and masked figure came striding into the room. He said, you, Professor Adams? He said, yes, trembling. And he said, you teach a course in Edwards? He said, yes. And you tell the students you're a skeptic and don't believe in metamorphoses. Yes, pulls out a great big pistol and fires at him. There's a great cloud of smoke. There's a great cloud of smoke. And when the smoke cleared, there was a chicken on the desk in place of Bob Adams. This is Tony Capote. And so the students were stupefied. And one of the students got up and ran into the English office just up the hall and said, you know, terrible things happened, terrible. What is it, says Slatoff, while Slatoff was reading the paper. said, "By heavens, it's just turned into a chicken." And he said, "No wonder, that's all they pay us around here is chicken." That's actually happening.
Good for him.
But there was Tony. They cooked this up together. Uh-huh. So that was Tony's greatest role.
Yes. I
was
really, should have had five.
That didn't fit so well.
Five vignettes in your
I gave four little reminiscences of this would have been number, but it didn't belong. I'll save this for something else.
That's very good.
But that indicates something about the atmosphere of our department. It was pretty slap-happy.
Well, let's see. Are there other things we want to ask about? We haven't really talked about changes in the general field of literary studies, but I don't know if that's a topic you're interested in talking about. Lifetime has seen, has witnessed great transformations.
Both of you are among the great changers. So.
Well, what I felt when I was here was that the department, and I think this was your doing, was remarkably accepting of interesting things that weren't particularly what was your thing. And that's the kind of diversity you were talking about.
Yeah, as long as there's open argument. I mean, that's why I've always felt that. I've always had a complaint that may not apply now, and at the National Humanities Center in North Carolina, which I was one of the people who helped found. And it was run in a very conservative way. Bill Bennett was a director for a while. And they never had any of the people who taught these innovative things, like deconstruction and the rest, represented there. And I fought all the time against this and said, you're letting... That's at the very energy center of the field now. You may disapprove of it, but you have to let it fight itself out against people who will ask the right questions, who have a reasonable grounds to oppose it. I remember using the analog that you've turned the place into a cloister and it should be a forum. It should be a combination of forum and cloister. Never got that way. I don't think they ever asked anybody who represented one. Even Stanley Fisher was nearby at Duke, never was appointed to the center. Uh-huh. Now I think it's different.
I think it's changed now.
But now that the war's over, really, things have stabilized in a new equilibrium. Mm-hmm. But in those days, of course, these were the threatening new areas.
But Jonathan, when you were being considered in 1977, there was a faculty meeting, and all the non-deconstructive members of the department, which were the department, basically, were saying, yes, he's a bright, interesting fellow. But they were also saying, but we knew his father. We knew his father. He can't be all that bad.
At one point, it's just structuralism. It's not yet deconstruction.
But at one point, Scott Ehrlich...
Structuralist, that's right. Your point is...
That's right. At one point, Scott Ehrlich said, yeah, he's got a lot of snap and crackle. And I said, and pop?
Well, as Lloyd was telling, reminiscing about that sort of thing, I remember when we were hunting for an Americanist, and we wrote to Joel Porte at Harvard, do you have anybody to recommend? He says, what about me? This was a source of great glee to some of these people in the department, but as Joel's already a distinguished scholar of the field, ex-chairman of the
former chair of the Harvard.
Maybe he was chair at the time.
Maybe chair then. So that may have been what drove him away from Harvard.
And we had a meeting, and it was just the opposite then. He was too conventional for some of the people.
I remember hearing about that. I wasn't here then.
And Jonathan stepped in. I think you turned the tide. I remember Jonathan spoke up and said, he's a good man, and we'd, be totally irrational not to sees this as a duty to appoint a first-rate person. And so, whatever the area of his or theory or non-theoretical position. So, that's the way the department fumbled along.
I do have a feeling that these days there's more sort of ressentiment about senior appointments. People know, not wanting to hire somebody senior if, unless they see them as a, see him or her as a direct ally or something.
No,
so
that's
people
right.
can always this can always take the form of getting on your moral high horse about we shouldn't be trying to hire senior people, we should hire junior people. Mm. So it's, it can be disguised,
both.
But you really do need
have to do both. Yeah.
You have to take advantage of the opportunities when they for senior appointments when they arise.
Exactly. But you get a chance to appoint somebody you know is good and not somebody who promises maybe to be good. Of course you must seize it. Whatever the area.
Yes. You mentioned Thomas Pynchon as a student of yours. Are there any other memories of students who went on to achieve some fame?
Well, no, you weren't a student. Well, Sandra Gilbert, who was just visiting professor here this past year. And, I think I was... It was when she... She's perhaps the leading feminist of the day in influence through publication. And of course, quite an interesting poet, a very accomplished poet, in addition to all her work in literary criticism, editing important volumes, writing important volumes. But I said to her, Sandra, I think I probably taught more first-rank feminist scholars and critics than anybody in America. And we started to list them, and it was really an astonishing group. There was Sandra and Joanna Russ, who was a novelist of some note, a feminist. And there was Eve Sedgwick, her name is Kozowski, and she was here. There was Gayatri Chakraborty, who was post-colonial plus deconstructionist plus feminist, but feminist. And various others. And that came about unintentionally. That was an unexpected product of my teaching. And I don't know how it happened.
Outside, are there students from who ended up outside of literary studies who went on to fame or notoriety in other realms? I mean, people like, I don't know, Paul Wolfowitz was a Cornelian,
Harold Bloom is my most famous student outside of possibly.
Yeah.
Harold was always comparing himself to other people and also has a stronger patriarchal view of the relationships of people. I'm his intellectual father, and his students are my grandchildren. He introduced me to his students as my grandchildren. And he's very serious about it and very edible about it, so you're always a little bit on shaky ground when it comes to this sort of thing. But Harold once said to me, you know, probably your most successful student was Tom Pynchon, not me. I was thinking that way.
That's great. Probably there.
And, well, Harold was a student up and down. I mean, he took many courses with me, and I saw him all the time, had him at the house and so on. Tom Pynchon, I only was one of his teachers in just one of his courses. I can't take any
credit for him in the same
Pynchon,
way.
Really.
I think we've covered.
How did the department shape up when you joined it? Was it a distinguished department at the time?
Yeah. Coming from Harvard, it certainly felt like a distinguished department. It took me a while to get to know what people were doing.
I remember you lived way out in the country. And
way out in the country.
Yeah.
I'd been told not to do that by Steve Parrish. He said, that would be a big mistake. We'd already bought the house.
Did you buy it from Fred Kahn? Or?
We bought it. No, there were a couple of intermediate owners.
I visited that house. The two dominions were first with Fred Kahn's and then yours.
This is a house on Culver Road, I should say, for the record here.
I still have pictures of you getting a kite to fly.
I remember you showed it to me once.
The last party we had before we left Cornell, we had a big party with the same musicians that we heard the other night downtown. 35 years ago.
It's been 35 years?
83, no, 25 since you left.
Well, I was going to say, I'm 25.
I think this opportunity shouldn't pass before we talk about Jonathan's joining the department, because that was very an interesting peripheral role in that, I remember. We met first when I was at Oxford, was that it? When I was at All Souls. And I met you and Cynthia. At that time, there was no connection with Cornell, was there? I remember you took me to a picnic once next to some ancient ruins.
That's right, out in the country.
Yeah.
And I've forgotten the exact chronology, whether we had already visited Cornell,
Certainly,
I wasn't yet at Cornell, and I was still in Oxford.
Still at Oxford.
Yes.
And then you came with Cynthia to visit Cornell, or made the offer. Mm-hmm. And I remember distinctly. We were dining in that railroad car at the station, that fancy old railroad car.
Yes.
Do they still serve meals?
It's a station restaurant.
Oh, things change. But anyway, it was at that point the two of you told me you decided to come. Mm-hmm. That was very nice. I enjoyed that.
I remember that dinner with at the station restaurant, and then shortly after
That was obviously after we'd met in.
I think that's right. Yes, you're right. You're right. It was the Oxford would have been before then. But I then remember after we arrived asking you, so are there any good restaurants in Ithaca? And you said, well, I think you had forgotten that you had taken me to the station. There's the station. It's not very good, but we often take visitors there because it's kind of cute. But it's true. It did not impress me. It was not one of the factors luring me to Ithaca.
Well, eating in a private car must have been impressive.
That's impressive. But I had met Neil before in Cambridge. I met you several years before in Cambridge. 74, when you were on leave and talked about Flaubert.
Well, nowadays you can say pretty good things about comestibles.
Ithaca's approved a great deal. But I remember, it was really a culinary desert until Harry Levin? Who was the dean? Was he the one who owned the Auberge part of the Auberge du Cochon Rouge, which he started?
And also the sculptor Jason Seeley.
They
all helped finance restaurant. Its beginning.
And then the Cornellians had to get this restaurant
started. Instead of collecting money from it, they could have a certain number of free meals with their friends there through the year. It was very nice. That was a very good restaurant.
Yes, but so I knew I'd met you and I knew Neil and I guess I knew Phil Lewis and Richard. I've not forgotten exactly Richard Klein. But I remember thinking that this would be good. I'll be in the English department, but since I have no interest in the English department, have these friends in romance studies, etc. I'll have a minimal involvement with English and can just get my work done. This will be a very good arrangement. But of course, it didn't work out that way. Get here, you become deeply involved in whatever department it is that you're.
How did the department look when you joined it? I've forgotten what the context was at the time.
Yeah. I don't think it was a. Of course, I had not really been in English study. I'd been doing French and literary theory and comparative literature. So that was part of my thinking about there's this department where there are all these people who do something different from what I do. And this was the days of the theory revolution, so I was much more involved with the people around diacritics, including Neil. But I didn't really wasn't really assessing the English department as a place to be. But, it was still a place where I felt certainly that there was a conservative older guard, people who I got along with perfectly well, like Scott Ellidge, and Scott was not. Then there were people like Mike Colacurcio, who was always rather an Americanist, who was rather disdainful of theory. I remember each time we would search for an Americanist, Colacurcio would complain that we were shortlisting people who really weren't Americanists because they read Foucault or didn't read Puritan sermons or whatever it was. And each time we hired, he would usually agree, okay, you can hire this person as long as you don't tell yourself that you have fulfilled your Americanist position, because this person is Deborah Freed, who had written on, I don't know, Shakespeare in 19th century American literature, or Mark Seltzer, who had footnotes to Foucault and his book on Henry James, etc. None of these were proper Americanists for Carl Curcio. And he was quite a forceful, I guess you had already retired at that point, but
he was a forceful spokesman for his
point of view in department meetings. So
because he was smart, and his argument smart.
Oh, he was a good fellow.
Sharp,
good,
yeah.
He sort of disappeared after he left here.
Yes.
Has he done anything?
I haven't. He's still at UCLA, and I think
maybe retired.
He may be retired by now. But yes. Yeah.
So, you know the famous story about Mark Seltzer, don't you?
No, what's that?
Mark Seltzer was sort of a hot graduate student when he was coming out of Berkeley, and he had offers from Cornell, Yale, and Columbia.
Pretty good.
So he flew east to visit all these campuses. He'd come here to Cornell, and he'd gone down to New York, and then he'd come up to Columbia, to Yale, where he was taken out for supper by Harold Bloom, Hillis Miller, Paul DeMann, just the three of them, and Mark Seltzer, graduate student. Bloom does most of the talking, and the point is, he should come to Yale because there's no point in going anyplace else. Who's at Columbia in your field? Nobody. Who's at Cornell in your field? Cushing Strout. What does Cushing Strout do? He does magic tricks.
Very Bloomian.
DeMann is very quiet. At the end of the dinner, they get up. DeMann turns to Seltzer and says, we at Yale also have our magic tricks. The moment you arrive, all of us shall disappear.
Oh, that's a great story. Yeah. Oh, that's the best of DeMann, right there.
That's a wonderful.
I remember when he was coming here for a visit before he was offered the appointment, and somebody asked him what the situation was in the literature field at Harvard, and he says, it's like this. He says, Harry Levin plays the flute, and we all go like this, and like this. I've never forgotten that.
Well, perhaps that's a good note on the flute. Cornell. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you so much.
Well, it's fun to talk about these things. Yes. There are lots more stories, of course. We'll try it again sometime, maybe.